This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power the collaboration needed for teams to accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from space exploration and green energy to delivering pizzas and podcasts. Whether you're a team of 2, 200, or 2 million, Atlassian software is built to keep you connected and moving together as one.
Ready to find your next favorite podcast? Spotify makes it easier than ever to discover new favorites by previewing short audio clips before committing to a full listen. You can even watch some podcasts with video or just keep playing audio in the background. It's everything you want in one app. Music, podcasts, and audiobooks across any device. Play anytime, anywhere, any way you'd like with Spotify. Try today.
Final seconds. All eyes and ears on one Carlos Guerra, the Guatemalan referee. Jones into the corner. The whistle. It's done! It's over! It is over! Trinidad, with nothing to play for, has dethroned the United States, knocking them out of the World Cup 2018.
I'm sorry, U.S. soccer fans. I'm sorry we made you relive this moment. The moment when the United States failed to make it to the 2018 World Cup. It all came down to their final game against Trinidad and Tobago. Trinidad and Tobago were in last place in the division and had no chance of qualifying. The U.S. had made the last 7 World Cups, and this time, all they needed was a tie. So when the U.S. lost, it was a pretty shocking upset. People were in disbelief.
It's hard to imagine a worse night in soccer terms for the U.S.
They were angry.
With the amount of money that is in Major League Soccer and in this sport, you can't get a draw, a tie against Trinidad?
They felt hopeless.
I physically ached. It was a disappointment and a sadness and a shame. This team, they failed themselves, they failed the sport, and they failed their country.
Yes, this one hurts. And people have the right to be upset. But the fact that they're upset at all shows how far soccer has come in America. These days, people expect the U.S. to make the World Cup. And this is something we should appreciate. Because not so long ago, the U.S. was a laughingstock when it came to soccer. This story takes us back to 1989. That year, a ragtag group of players in short shorts got the U.S. into the World Cup for the first time in decades and finally put American soccer on the map. I'm Nando Vila, and this is We Came to Win. Soccer is the most popular sport in the world. But for decades, it just never caught on in America. Sports fans here were too busy with baseball, football, basketball, NASCAR. Tab Ramos played on the U.S. national team in the 80s and 90s, and he went on to become one of the best American players in history. He remembers what it was like to be a young soccer player in America in the 1970s.
I lived in Uruguay until I was 11 years old. I was almost 12 when I moved to the U.S., I remember being upset and telling my dad that of all the countries in the world to move to, why did we have to move somewhere where soccer doesn't exist?
After months of kicking a ball alone on the playground, he heard about a rec soccer league. He was pretty excited about it until he got onto the field.
It's on the outfield of a baseball field. You know, the goals are little. I would score on goal kicks every time I took a shot. And so the people at the rec place just basically told me I couldn't play there anymore.
If you were a good player, like Tab Ramos, the U.S. didn't offer much opportunity. There was a professional league in the 60s, but by the 80s, it had folded. The best option was to play pro indoor soccer, but that was a completely different game. With 5 players a side, a smaller field enclosed by 4 walls, and the ball crashing around like in a pinball machine. It's as if Major League Baseball folded, and the only option for ball players was to play pro wiffle ball. And if that doesn't convince you that the U.S. was a soccer desert, well, the World Cup says it all. By 1988, it had been almost 4 decades since the U.S. qualified for the World Cup. They couldn't even make it to the final stage of qualifying. It seems weird to call the United States of America an underdog in anything, but in soccer, they really were. And it was against this backdrop, in July of 1988, that soccer fans got this news.
The United States will host the 1994 World Cup Soccer Tournament. That is in 1994. They'll have several venues throughout the United States, Los Angeles, Stanford Stadium in California. So it should be exciting.
Good. I like soccer. That's a fun game to watch. Yep.
You'd think these newscasters from Spokane, Washington were talking about a local Little League game. But they were talking about the World Cup. This was a big deal. The U.S. was about to host the World Cup for the first time in history. All the best soccer players from around the world would be playing in Chicago, Los Angeles, and New York, and Americans would get to see them. This meant that they might actually start to care about soccer. Plus, since the U.S. was hosting, they'd get a spot in the 1994 tournament. But if the only way they could make the World Cup was to host, well, that was kind of embarrassing. No one wants to make it on a technicality. You want to earn it. Luckily, that was 6 years away. The U.S. had one final chance to prove they could qualify on merit, and that was the 1990 World Cup in Italy. It was 9 months until the World Cup qualifiers started in earnest, and this was the situation. The national team had no money, most of the players were amateurs, and the current coach worked part-time as a maitre d'. The U.S. Soccer Federation wanted to take the team in a new direction, so they decided to bring on a new coach who could pull a team together that might actually give them a shot at the World Cup. They landed on a man named Bob Gansler.
I'm pretty much a lifer. If somebody will have me, I'll walk around in short pants.
Gansler was working with the under-20 national team, which was a pretty good coaching gig. But then Werner Fricker, the U.S. soccer president, asked him, was he up for taking over the men's national team? Our producer, Emma Morgenstern, asked Bob Gansler about that moment.
What did he actually say to you when he asked you?
It had to be something like, well, are you gonna be goofy enough to want to do this?
It was goofy because Gansler already had one of the few stable jobs in U.S. soccer. And if he took Fricker's offer, he was giving it up to be U.S. soccer's Don Quixote, tilting at the World Cup windmill. But he just couldn't turn down the highest coaching position in the U.S. Bob Gansler officially became the coach in January of 1989.
We do our utmost, right, to qualify, and all sorts of good things are going to come our way. It's doable, so let's go and do it.
It's doable, so let's go and do it. This is typical Gansler. Stoic, hard to impress. At that time, Gansler was pushing 50, with brown hair and a square jaw, still in good enough shape to kick your ass. He looked like a coach. You can just see him saying, drop and give me 20. But Gansler couldn't do much without a good group of players, and they weren't so easy to find. In other countries, like Italy or England or Mexico, there are entire leagues full of world-class players vying for a spot on their national teams. But America's best hope was amateur players lurking on college teams or semi-pro club teams or indoor teams, maybe a few guys playing abroad. So Gansler would have to go, not scouting, but scavenging. And there was a problem.
There was no money for me to travel around to watch players play.
Most national team coaches have a network of scouts they use to monitor dozens of potential players. But Gansler's only option was to call everyone he knew and ask, did they know anyone good?
Well, I had former teammates. I had friends in soccer that I coached with or against that were in New York and also were in San Francisco, were in Houston and also were in Minneapolis.
With his friends' help, Gansler did the best he could. He chose Bruce Murray, a forward who was playing for Lucerne in Switzerland's top pro league. He was one of the few Americans good enough to play abroad.
I had my own place at Lake Lucerne, and I had my own car, and I was playing with grown men. And this is the patriotic part of me. I left, I think, probably a better opportunity financially to come back and help the United States qualify for the World Cup.
Then there was Paul Crumpy, whose most recent paying soccer gig was playing indoor. Crumpy was excited to play for the national team, but he worried there was no future playing soccer in America. He wanted to keep his options open, so he got a second job.
Even though I was under a full-time contract with the national team, I still, you know, I was trying to use my aerospace degree. I was an aerospace engineering major. I got a job with McDonnell Douglas designing aircraft.
A national team player who worked as an aerospace engineer. They also had Tony Miola, a goalkeeper.
But there's Miola, who's so strong in the air.
Steve Trichu, defender. Paul Caligiuri, midfielder. And then there was Tab Ramos, the kid who got kicked off his rec team for being too good.
He was an artist. Yeah, he could do things with a ball that nobody else could. The best player we had.
Gansler got his team together for the first time in January of 1989. They were a super young, motley crew. If you look at a team photo of them, you'll see a bunch of kids who can barely grow a mustache, but can definitely grow a mullet. Seriously, so many mullets. It was now 3 months before their first World Cup qualifier, and they had a lot to do. Get in shape, learn to trust each other, become a team.
We would get together for a training camp for a week and play a game, right? And then I'd send these guys home, and we'd give them homework.
Why was that the arrangement? Like, why did you not have money to keep everybody around full time? Like, why was that?
You got it. You hit it. we were doing things on borrowed money.
Gansler says that Werner Fricker, the president of U.S. Soccer, paid for some of their training camps out of his own pocket. But there wasn't enough money to train full-time, so the players would go to camp for a couple weeks, then head home for a while.
It was very difficult to be a soccer player and be on and off throughout the year for 2 weeks at a time. It was just really strange.
That's Paul Crumpy, the engineer. Between training sessions, he'd go back home to Torrance, California. Now, there's no great way to practice soccer, a team sport, on your own, so he improvised.
There was like a wall, so I would go and knock the ball against the wall. It was a lot of running on my own, striking the ball on my own, working on foot skills, things like that, so that I was at least capable of jumping back in with the national team when we got called back into camp.
These guys were preparing for a World Cup by kicking a ball against the wall? My middle school team wouldn't even do that. Every month or so, the team came back together for several days of training camp. They didn't have a permanent facility, so they'd usually train on a college campus in either California or Florida. After practice, they'd bunk together at a second-rate hotel. And all the things you associate with professional sports, nutritionists, doctors on call, physical therapists, fans, those were things they did not have. Even their uniforms were crappy.
An Adidas cotton t-shirt, shorts that were basically probably too small for us, and socks that would shrink every time you washed them.
It's like wearing a garbage bag sometimes. They were really tight, and they were form-fitting, and like on a humid day, you'd like lose probably 25 pounds.
The guys I spoke to also said that the uniforms that they wore were just awful. Was that
what wusses? I tell you what. Now you're just taking my opinion of these guys down a peg. Well, what's the story here? We were never spoiled. Let's put it that way. You are as good as you play. End of the story.
As soon as they got back to camp, they'd get into their crappy uniforms and head to the field. Gansler made sure they were keeping up with their training.
They knew that when we came back and, you know, and when we got together again, there had to be a test. We used to run, it's a 2 mile test.
2 miles in under 12 minutes.
2 miles in 12 minutes shouldn't have been that hard for professional athletes, but it was rough on them.
Guys would be throwing up at times.
Holding your teammate's mullet back while he pukes, perhaps not the most desirable task, but the kind of shared experience that can really bring guys together.
We had that type of mentality as a team. Let's work for each other. You know, let's get through this together. Those guys, we would die for each other on that field.
Any team where everybody's pulling in the same direction has an opportunity to win.
But off the field, there were still plenty of doubters. Here's John Stollmeyer, a defensive midfielder.
I remember how newspapers or Soccer America or whoever, they would constantly say how how we weren't very good, how we weren't good, how we couldn't do this, couldn't do that.
Maybe those criticisms weren't totally fair, but the team had to face reality. Here's Tad Ramos.
We were a national team that really had no home, really no fans, to be honest. And we're just a bunch of kids trying to get U.S. soccer to qualify to a World Cup somehow.
The only way they could prove the haters wrong would be on the field, and they'd have their first chance very soon, right after this break.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. I was traveling internationally last year. I was in Mallorca. I didn't know the island well. I said, let me head to the north, head towards the water. Let me go on Hotels.com and see what they have available. Something preferably on the beach, maybe even a gym. Not only did I get those things, there was a kids session with exercise, gymnastics in the water, pony rides, a train. It had everything, and I didn't even want any of those things. But at least I knew they were there, just in case I changed my mind. And now finding the perfect hotel has never been easier thanks to the Hotels.com app. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly, right, all-inclusive, or a relaxing spa weekend, you can find exactly what you need and compare hotel prices, ratings, and amenities side by side. So start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app.
Calling all podcast fans, Spotify makes it easier than ever to discover new shows to love. Get personalized episode recommendations and easily preview them before you dive right in. Find exclusive video episodes from your favorite hosts and guests. And with some, you can even connect with them through polls and Q&A directly within their episodes. It's everything you want in one app. So what are you waiting for? Try the podcast experience today on Spotify.
Before Bob Gansler and the U.S. team ever stepped onto a field, they caught a massive break. See, the U.S. qualifies out of the CONCACAF division. I'll say it again so we're all on the same page here. CONCACAF. It's the region that covers North America, Central America, and the Caribbean. In 1989, there were five teams vying for two spots at the World Cup. Mexico was a powerhouse. They were almost always in the top two, but not that year.
Emoción mundial y nacional causó hoy la sanción aplicada por la FIFA al fútbol mexicano.
This is a clip from a Mexican newscast in 1988. That year, Mexico put four overage players on their under-20 national team in violation of the rules. As a result, Mexico couldn't play in international matches for 2 years. That meant they were out of the 1990 World Cup. This changed everything for the U.S. Now, instead of competing for one spot, there were two. Here's Paul Crumpy.
In any league or any conference, you take away the best team, and it opens it up for anybody else to be able to qualify and go.
But even with Mexico gone, there was still a long road ahead. Over 6 months, the team would play 8 games. Costa Rica would be their toughest opponent, and that's who they were up against first. The match was set for April 16th, 1989, in Costa Rica. Now, people there care a lot about soccer. Fans will do anything to help their team win, including messing with their opponents. Bruce Murray remembers that the Costa Rican fans wouldn't let them sleep the night before the game.
The fire alarms are going off all night. They're sending an ambulance around the hotel with the sirens on all night.
The next morning, the hotel staff did their part to psych out the team.
We come down for breakfast, and there's five televisions on rolling carts in our breakfast area, and what they're showing is they're showing a sold-out stadium, drunken fans just going bananas, and there was no mistake that the catering staff made sure that we had those televisions in there.
The U.S. players were shocked at what they saw. It was nothing like playing back home. The hype in Costa Rica rattled them. To boost their confidence, Coach Gansler gave one of his signature pep talks, which usually went something like,
I just said, hey, we're here. If it's possible, right, then it's doable.
Yet not exactly Mel Gibson in Braveheart, but that was the Bob Gansler way. The team headed out to the pitch, and right from kickoff, it was clear that they were out of their depth. It was hot, with 26,000 Costa Rican fans in the stands hassling them.
It was a really difficult environment. Costa Rican fans were very much on, you know, on top of us. We were not used to having, you know, fans yelling so much and the game being so loud.
Just 14 minutes into the game, Costa Rica scored.
Oh, what tragedy for the United States. As Roden, the newcomer, claims the goal, and the crowd is in seventh heaven.
After falling behind early, the U.S. couldn't turn it around. Despite the months of hard work, they lost the game 1-0.
I remember walking off thinking, how did we let that get away from us?
I felt like, gosh, now it's going to really be a really slog uphill. You know, it's a monster climb. You know, you lose the first game. We all thought each game was like life and death.
Tab Ramos knew there was only one way the team would pull through.
Well, I think the one thing that was really important to us that we thought could keep us in the hunt for a spot was not to lose at home. So we felt like games on the road are going to be really difficult. You know, if we can get, you know, a tie here or a tie there, but if we can win our home games, we put ourselves in good position.
2 weeks later, the U.S. played Costa Rica again, this time at home in St. Louis.
And I recall coming in with the team bus and seeing the sign, no more tickets. It was sold out. And it was the first time that we thought, wow, you know, this is great. People are paying attention to us.
Just to be clear, St. Louis Soccer Park only holds 8,500 people. But that was 8,500 more fans than they were expecting.
I thought that was like the greatest thing that had ever happened to me.
And that sold-out crowd made the difference. The U.S. and Costa Rica played a tight game. Deep into the second half, they were still tied 0-0. But with 18 minutes to go, Tab Ramos latched onto a loose ball.
Left it for Ramos. Shot. Score! Ramos!
For me, that was huge, so I'll never forget that goal.
The goal proved to be enough. The U.S. beat Costa Rica 1-0. Afterward, Tab Ramos went back to his hotel room. He started keeping track of the division standings. He had his own little primitive data center.
It was probably the first time for me that I said, okay, here are all the teams. Here are the games remaining.
He started to game out the rest of the qualifying tournament.
Here's what we would do if the other teams did this. What do we have to do to win? So I'm sure that was the first time for me where I did that.
Qualification felt like it was within reach. It felt possible. But they still had 6 of their 8 games to go. They tied Trinidad and Tobago at home. Then they beat Guatemala at home. Then they won against El Salvador away, and tied with Guatemala away, and tied with El Salvador at home. With just one game left, the U.S. was in third place. Costa Rica clinched first place and a spot in the World Cup. In second place, Trinidad and Tobago. The U.S. would have to beat them to get a spot at the World Cup. Yes, just like in 2017, it would all come down to a game against Trinidad. But this time, Trinidad only needed a tie. The U.S. needed to win. The Americans knew this game could make or break their careers. If they didn't win, their contracts with the national team would be over. And most of them had no shot of playing pro soccer anywhere else. Here's Bruce Murray.
I was getting married a week later. I had a house I was closing on. Everyone had everything on the line. Okay, if we don't qualify, then none of these things are going to happen.
Okay, Bruce Murray probably still would have gotten married, but this was a huge moment. The future of soccer in America was at stake. Here's Steve Trichu.
If we didn't qualify, then we didn't have jobs. And then also, you know, there was talk at the time that if we didn't qualify, that maybe they might take the 94 World Cup away from the United States. There was a lot of pressure on us, I think, at the time.
Coach Gansler organized one final training camp for his team. He held it in Florida because the hot, swampy weather was similar to Trinidad. Here are John Stollmeyer and Bob Gansler.
We stayed at the development academy down there. So that was basically like, you know, cinder block, real Spartan atmosphere, nothing fancy about it. And we played hard that week, and
we even flew in Bermuda from the island to play us. Why Bermuda? Because the way they play and the way Trinidad played is similar.
And then it was time. The team set off for Trinidad.
So we took a Pan Am charter down to Trinidad and Tobago, and we got maybe 10 minutes outside the airport, and the pilot came on, and he said,
"Listen, I want to wish you guys good luck, but I just want you to know that there's about 25,000 people here at the airport waiting to greet you."
Yeah, greet is probably not the right word. The fans came to the airport to scare the living bejesus out of them. They were decked out in red, Trinidad's color. They held signs and yelled at the U.S. players, hoping to intimidate them.
And we're like, what? Trinidad and Tobago had declared a national holiday because if they tied or won, they were going to the World Cup. So the whole country was off. So we started at the airport, and it was insanity. And then maybe a 40-minute bus ride to the hotel, every street lined with people in red, thousands of people lining the streets, you know, like saying that we're going to lose.
And Americans didn't exactly have their teams back.
I remember one question, and it was a journalist from the United States. The guy asked me, he says, "Well, sir, how are you going to feel tomorrow after the game and when you realize that you didn't make it and you had this great opportunity, et cetera, et cetera?"
Friends like these, huh? They woke up the morning of the game.
Well, there was not much math to do that day. It was we had to win to qualify to the World Cup. Anything but a win and we're out.
As they made their way to the game, the streets were packed with people.
The bus ride to the stadium was 4-3-2 miles an hour, just creeping down the street.
They arrived at the national stadium and headed into the locker room.
It's a terrible, old, crickety old facility, and it's hot. I mean, it's roasting, and it's humid, and it's in the locker room. There's no air conditioning. It's just, you know, and you can hear everything, and you can hear the crowd roaring, and you can hear the PA announcer, and then the crowd roars. And there's nobody in the locker room. They had a lot of you know, all that stuff about, no, you have to, no matter what, you have to believe you can win. We all were doubting ourselves.
Coach Gansler didn't want them thinking that way.
He said, you just believe in yourselves. He goes, because nobody out there believes in you. He said, but you believe in yourself, okay? And go have fun. Enjoy the moment.
On the field, the U.S. would face a really strong Trinidad team. This was Trinidad's golden generation. They had a fresh-faced 18-year-old Dwight York, who would later go on to become a legend at Manchester United. Then there was Russell Latipi, the creative midfielder who would later play in Portugal and Scotland. On paper, they'd be a tough team to beat. But the Trinidad players were acutely aware of what they were trying to do. Tie or win to bring their country to the World Cup for the first time ever. It was exciting, but also a big burden.
I remember being in the tunnel with the Trinidad players because both teams line up together before you come out. And I felt like this was a Trinidad team that was a little lost. You could see it in their eyes. You could see it was a team that was under a tremendous amount of pressure to tie this game. And I felt at that moment that, wow, I felt like we had a great opportunity.
I still get goosebumps when I think about walking out of the tunnel because the crowd was already in place. I remember doing a full 360, looking around going, oh my God.
Every single person had red on in that stadium.
And you see the sea of red.
Nothing but a sea of red. For the first time when they played the national anthem, I was crying, but it wasn't because I thought we were going to win. I thought I was like, you know, pride in my country. I'm thinking we're going to get or, you know, we're going to get our asses kicked today.
The USA national team must beat Trinidad and Tobago in order to advance to the World Cup in 1990. A tie or a loss will do them no good. And then Trinidad, in fact, would advance to the World Cup for the first time in their history. Clearly, this is the most important 90 minutes in the history of the players on the U.S. national team.
As play starts, the first two balls that came, my job is to hold the ball up, is to be the target man. And the first two balls that came in, I got wrecked from behind. I mean, wrecked by a big, strong Trinidadian defender. And I realized, like, I knew what was going to happen all the whole game. Is I was going to be a punching bag, but it was my job. That's my job.
The U.S. trying to put early pressure on and win the ball because Trinidad and Tobago tends to play around a little bit on defense. And particularly early on, can be a little bit lax.
Trinidad and Tobago had a few early chances to score, but couldn't make it happen.
Tackle, but it was a loose ball played right back into the area. Quick shot deflected by John Doyle, and that was helter-skelter for the USA in their own backyard. It's scoreless here in Trinidad and Tobago.
Every time Trinidad and Tobago regained possession, the crowd amped up the volume. Louder. And louder. And louder. And then, in the 30th minute, U.S. defender Brian Bliss took a routine throw-in. Tab Ramos went over to receive it.
And he threw the ball to me, and I couldn't control it properly. And I remember I gave Paul Calegari a really bad pass.
Now, Paul's directly 10 yards behind me. He flicks it back over to his left foot. I realize this crazy, you know what, is going to hit the ball. I'm like, don't do it. What are you doing?
Bring it in to Calegari. Beats the first man. A left-footed shot!
And I look, and I'm like, oh my God, this might go in.
The ball seems to just float through the air. It kind of just hangs there, as if time has stopped. And then it flies right in.
Paul Calegari has scored a goal of the USA! Lead 1-0! An amazing goal by Calegari, who made a great move to get by one player, and then hit the truck into this good move on the left foot. Just a super volley into that far corner and a stunning goal. This crowd absolutely cannot believe it.
It was a literal miracle, a true miracle.
By now you might have surmised I don't get overexcited all that often. And I didn't at that point either. I get up and I look and I say, okay, that'll do.
That might be the shot heard around the world.
And boy, putting Paul Calegari in the center of midfield has certainly paid off early for the U.S.
But the game wasn't over yet. They still had an hour left to play.
We had to get into halftime. We had to get all the assignments sorted out. We knew we were going to be under the gun in the second half. But there was belief.
We talked before about the most important 90 minutes of soccer in USA history. How about the next 45 and even less now?
Trinidad and Tobago sent countless balls into the box, putting pressure on Tony Miola, the U.S. goalkeeper. The U.S. team was holding on by a thread.
Oh, my God. Where do I start? They had wave after wave of attack crosses. Tony Miola came out and made some big, like some really, really ballsy plays where a goalkeeper usually stays on his line. He came out and challenged.
So now every ball is being sent in straight to goal. Everything is straight to the front runners. Anybody who can run, they're sending 2, 3, 4 guys up. And you're hoping nobody makes a mistake.
There was a Trinidad player that goes into our box and gets taken down. And it looks like it's going to be a penalty. And I remember watching the player go down inside our box and looking at the referee. And the referee, I think, took the whistle to his mouth. And I remember that moment being, this is getting ready to be like the worst moment of my life if he blows the whistle. And he doesn't blow the whistle. And it was like amazing. It was like that gave me at the moment more energy than the goal itself when it was scored.
They've been outstanding. Time running out, precious seconds left. The USA on a Paul Calegari goal from Tab Ramos at the 31st minute are trying to hold on and go to Italy, and they do! The USA has realized a dream. They will qualify for the World Cup in 1990. Unbelievable!
I think I fall to the ground. You know, I just, it was so exciting that it's overwhelming.
Just that gratifying relief feeling.
of I did it, you know, we did it. You know, with all the people that say you're not very good and you guys aren't can't do this, can't do that. You go, yeah, but we qualified for the World Cup.
Given very little chance down here, they show the courage, they show the competitiveness, JP, and they also show the composure under pressure, which has been made a lot about.
Against all odds, the U.S. had made it. Paul Caligiuri's goal would be known in U.S. soccer as the shot heard around the world.
The U.S. is going to Italy. This bid was earned. Congratulations to Bob Gansler and his team, who were given a snowball's chance in Tobago of winning today, but they won on the road.
The team felt like they were on top of the world. So then the U.S. went on to win the World Cup. Just kidding. Here's Bob Gansler.
Our first game was against Czechoslovakia. We were a little overly ambitious. We lost it 4-1, was it? Yeah, 4-1.
I think it was 5-1, and, no?
5-1, excuse me.
In fact, they lost all three games and were knocked out in the first round. But the U.S. team did earn respect for themselves and for the sport they loved. After decades, Americans had a soccer team they could root for. And other countries no longer saw the U.S. as a joke. 4 years later, the U.S. hosted the World Cup, drawing the biggest crowds of any tournament to date. The 94 team had a nice run, making it out of the group stage. And by 2002, they got to the quarterfinals, the final eight. Gone are the days of bad rec league soccer on a baseball field. Today, millions of Americans play soccer and watch soccer on TV. Major League Soccer has been around since 1996, with rabid fans filling up entire stadiums. A lot of the guys on that 1989 team never became household names. The memory has faded. But one thing's for sure. U.S. soccer would look a hell of a lot different without Bob Gansler and his boys. Okay. Time for the starting 11. Our center forward for this story is producer Emma Morgenstern. On the wings are producers Emily Ulbricht and Gofan Mputubwele. And our super subs are Anna Foley and Jasmine Romero. Our captain is senior producer Matt Nelson. Our coaches are editors Caitlin Kenny, Devin Taylor, and Jessica Weisberg. Sound design, mixing, and music by Bobby Lord. Our referee, aka fact checker, is Max Gibson. As always, you were tough but fair. Join us for the next episode. We're going back a few World Cups to 1974, to the story behind the most infamous free kick in history.
It was total chaos. Certain players were angry. We started arguing and we were calling each other on the phone. Come, we're going to meet.
We Came to Win is a production of Gimlet Media in association with Fusion. If you like the show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and tell your friends. Or maybe just start chanting, "We came to win, we came," whatever you feel most comfortable with. For photos and bonus content, including lots of mullets, follow Gimlet Media on Twitter. The handle is at Gimlet Media. Or share your own mullet or memories of this 1990 team using the hashtag We Came to Win. And you can also let us know what you think about the show.
We're deviating from our classic clip format tonight to show you a clip from a classic sport, soccer. This video.
Okay, so I just have one more thing to ask you about, which is the song that you guys recorded before the World Cup. Were you part of that?
I was.
Why are you saying it like that?
Because it was terrible. Together, you and the team mean victory. Yeah, maybe we don't need to bring too much attention to that. It's a part of the winning spirit. You gotta keep your chin up, and we'll be coming home with the World Cup. So put your best foot forward, together let's step. But make sure momentum is kept. Togetherness and unity means victory for you and me.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. When I went on my last holiday to Cape Town, it was amazing. My friends were there, the weather was phenomenal, and most importantly, the food was fantastic. But one thing I struggled with was finding the right places to stay.
You know, all I want is a great bed, a fantastic shower, and breakfast that doesn't end at 8 a.m. I'm on holiday, I'm still sleeping. I also like ease, and the Hotels.com app easily helps me to find a perfect hotel for every trip. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly getaway or a relaxing spa weekend, on the Hotels.com app, you can compare up to 5 hotels side by side. Now, why would you want to do that? So you can see prices, amenities, and star ratings. And best of all, you don't have to switch back and forth between options. See? Ease. So, start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app today.